Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You want economic indicators? I got economic indicators. Choo-choo trains, baby. If Warren Buffett likes them, they must be doing something right. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Nova Becoming Human on PBS, The Evolution of Evolution. Nova Becoming Human, Tuesday at 8, 7 Central on PBS. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, today the 3rd of November, and it is great to have you with us. Warren Buffett's holding company, Berkshire Hathaway, owns a whole lot of different things. It owns insurance companies and an ice cream maker. It owns an underwear manufacturer and a brick company. Pretty soon it's going to own the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad, too. Buffett says he's making a $34 billion bet on the economic future of the country. The guy is right up among the most successful investors ever, and this is the biggest investment he has ever made. But what do you suppose he's really betting on? We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find out.
Burlington Northern makes more money than any other rail company in the country. It has 32,000 miles of track that run through 28 states and two Canadian provinces. It plays a key role in the economy. It transports everything from consumer goods to corn. Lee Klasko is a transportation analyst at Longbow, a research firm. He says Warren Buffett is figuring that where the economy goes, the trains will follow.
What he's betting on is that, you know, given that the rail industry and transportation companies in general are imperative to the movement of goods, that when the economy does begin to pick up steam again, these companies will benefit.
Buffett seems to like playing with trains. He already owned about a quarter of Burlington Northern, and he owns stock in two other big players, Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern. One of Burlington Northern's most profitable businesses is carting coal. Frank O'Donnell's president of Clean Air Watch. It's a nonprofit environmental group. He says Buffett's acquisition is a sign he doesn't think the government's going to do much on global warming.
Well, this is very ominous from the standpoint of climate change. Warren Buffett is no dummy, and he seems to be making a multi-billion dollar bet that coal use is not only going to continue, but grow in the future.
He says Buffett's in this to make money, not to change policy. But people follow Buffett, and deals like this one could make it hard to convince Americans that we need to. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid dropped the big old health care hint today. Reid was asked if a bill would be passed by the end of the year, and he said he's not going to be, quote, bound by any timeline. That's a no, the way I hear that. Meanwhile, details of a Republican proposal to counter the Democrats' offering are trickling out. We don't know exactly what it would cost. The Congressional Budget Office is still running the numbers. But we do know the GOP is trying to convince voters it is more interested in cutting health care costs than the Democrats are. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
House Republicans say their plan boils down to cutting health care costs while Democrats would expand coverage. The GOP plans to offer its alternative as an amendment to the Democrats' health care overhaul. Republicans would curb malpractice lawsuits. They say that would save money because doctors wouldn't order unnecessary tests to keep from being sued. The GOP proposal would let small businesses pool together to buy insurance, and it would provide incentives for health savings accounts. Republican Aaron Schock of Illinois.
We're committed to finding ways to reduce costs and make health insurance more affordable to everyone to help get those 30 to 40 million Americans who don't have health insurance covered.
Republicans, like Democrats, say they want to help people with pre-existing conditions get affordable health care, but they leave out a number of key features of the Democrats' bill, including a government-run insurance option. Democrat Allison Schwartz of Pennsylvania says a government option would lower insurance rates.
Hopefully it would be able to provide those affordable rates and make sure that there is some competition in every region of the country.
Amitabh Chandra is a healthcare economist at Harvard. He says both Republicans and Democrats are ignoring a very expensive elephant in the room, soaring Medicare costs.
The elephant is like destroying all the China, and we know it, and we're not willing to do anything about it because of the politics.
Chandra says both parties think it would be political suicide to reform Medicare. but he says you can't contain health care costs without looking at Medicare. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
As fewer people read newspapers, fewer newspapers can afford the wire services, companies like the Associated Press. The Tribune Company said today it wants a trial separation from the AP. Next week, it's going to experiment with not using AP stories and pictures in its papers. That would include the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more now on the changing economics of journalism.
The bankrupt Tribune Company spends millions of dollars a year on its subscription to the Associated Press. Next week, it's going to test drive some less expensive services, like Reuters, Bloomberg, and the New York Times.
Well, we're essentially doing some comparison shopping.
Jerry Kern is vice president of editorial for Tribune Publishing.
What we're trying to learn here is if we can essentially unbundle wire services and buy only what we need.
Kern says Tribune papers, like the Los Angeles Times and Chicago Tribune, are using a lot less wire copy these days. And that's industry-wide, says media analyst Ken Doctor.
AP has been like a utility. It's kind of like running water for newspapers. It fills in big and little gaps in their coverage.
But now, Doctor says, papers are focusing more on local news and don't need the AP's vast offerings of international and national stories. Readers get so much of that from TV and the Internet. Earlier this year, the AP slashed prices to try to hold on to subscribers. That's not the answer, says Jeff Jarvis, journalism professor at City University of New York.
The fundamentals of the media economy are changing from a content economy to a link-based economy.
Jarvis says the AP needs to become a broker for those links, like helping the Baltimore Sun link to a story about GM from the Detroit Free Press, or providing links to news about the Tribune Company's AP Free Week. Maybe not. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
A little of this, a little of that on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. For all that has been written and said about the events of last fall, the collapse of Lehman Brothers and all of that, there are still a whole lot of questions not entirely answered, like who knew what and when did they know it, and why were certain decisions made? New York Times business writer Andrew Ross Sorkin answered some of those questions in his new book, Too Big to Fail, it's called. We talked earlier this week about the bank marriages and the bailouts and how fast all that stuff happened.
Some of the most pivotal decisions, momentous, you talk about $85 billion being given to AIG. That happened probably during conversations that are shorter than the one that we're going to be having. And so it is remarkable. The sprint, desperately trying to save the system, but of course they're also trying to save themselves.
Did they know they were trying to save the system? I mean, was that right up at the top of their minds?
You know, I'm going to give Hank Paulson and the government a little bit more credit than I think they've gotten, which is I think they did see the dominoes lined up. When Bear Stearns was sold to J.P. Morgan, we went into this sort of months, frankly, of complacency where we thought the markets had gotten better, things were going to improve. And during that whole period, the spring through the summer, they are watching things get worse. And in fact, the thing that sticks in my mind is that we all saw TARP written, you know, remember that three-page document in September of 2008. But in fact, there's a memo, the break-the-glass memo, written on April 15th, which is eerily, almost freakishly similar to TARP. It is TARP.
Break-the-glass in case of emergency, right?
Exactly. It said, you know, we might have to pump the system with, at that time, what they were saying was $500 billion worth of cash into and buy these toxic assets. And that's something to think that they were thinking about that in April.
Well, if they knew then, why did Lehman Brothers go under?
It's a great question. There's all this sort of government intervention efforts even before September. So you'll see Hank pressing Warren Buffett to make an investment back in March of 2008. You'll see Treasury trying to actually make a deal with Barclays in April. You'll see them bring Bank of America. You know, we thought they showed up in September. They're having secret meetings in July. And so they see the train barreling down the track, and yet they're all trying to get out of the way or make a deal to do something, and yet it doesn't happen. And I think by the end, there's a sense, I don't want to say that they threw up their hands, but I think they thought this is a lost cause. There was so much political pressure also at that point about whether to save another financial institution. The backlash was big, and that's where it was.
You know, it's interesting. You refer to these guys on a first-name basis, Ben and Hank and Vikram and Jamie. And obviously you had some access to write this book. And you talk about this right in the acknowledgement section. You know, the people gave you their diaries and their personal calendars and notes they took at these meetings. Do you think that they knew and realized that they were writing history as they were going along and making this stuff up?
There was a CEO who, very early on in the interview process, actually did sit down with me. And I have to say, by the way, it was not easy getting a lot of these folks to play along, at least in the beginning. But the CEO came to the meeting and he brought his notes from that fateful weekend of Lehman Brothers. And these were, I have to tell you, the most remarkable notes I'd ever seen, better than any reporter. And I said to him, why are you giving me this stuff? And he said, for the same reason I took them, which is I knew this was history in the making. So I do believe that some of these people did have a sense that this was going to be a moment in time that we would be reflecting on for many, many years.
Andrew Ross Sorkin is the mergers and acquisitions correspondent for the New York Times. He's got a book out, too, about the events of last fall. It's called Too Big to Fail. Andrew, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
We talked for about 20 minutes all told. If you want to hear Andrew Ross Sorkin's take on Timothy Geithner and Jamie Dimon and all the gang on Wall Street in Washington, you can hear the rest of that interview on our website. It's marketplace.org. It's not all that surprising that giving first-time homebuyers an $8,000 discount on their taxes has helped stabilize the housing market. It's also not so surprising that with the credit set to expire at the end of the month, signs are it's going to be extended a while. Commentator David Abramowitz says keeping the credit alive is all well and good, but it needs a little work first.
Why not extend the $8,000 first-time homebuyer tax credit? Everyone loves a tax break, especially when you get a quick check from the government. But Congress should at least target the credit to the people and places that really need it. Instead, the majority of people who've taken advantage of the credit so far apparently would have bought a house anyway. A recent National Association of Realtors study showed that only 350,000 buyers would not have bought a home without the credit. Yet nearly 2 million people will get $8,000 checks this year. That means the rest of us taxpayers spent over $40,000 to get that one truly new purchaser out of five to buy a house. The scattershot nature of this credit highlights its central flaw. It just isn't targeted towards the problems it was billed as solving, turning around communities hardest hit by foreclosures and plunging home prices. Worse, Congress is heading in the opposite direction, boosting eligible buyer incomes to $250,000. That's five times the national median income, and handing out $8,000 checks for homes costing up to $800,000. Giving tax credits to well-paid lawyers in relatively untouched Seattle or Houston does nothing to boost home sales in areas with rampant foreclosures and struggling economies. Instead, focus home buying assistance on hard-hit areas like Las Vegas, Miami, and Oakland. One idea is to offer the credit only for modestly priced homes. That way, the hardest-hit communities would become magnets for buyers. Economic stimulus would flow to places where home values have dropped and economies have suffered the most. We do need to break the cycle of foreclosures and neighborhood destabilization. That remains critical to the nation's overall economic recovery. But for a program that may cost more than $11 billion for just a five-month extension, we should insist on maximum bang for the buck.
David Abramowitz is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. You can send us your comments online is best. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, the high cost of attending a for-profit school.
Students who default on their student loans have their Social Security benefits intercepted, have their tax returns intercepted, have their wages garnished. They are ruined for life.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials dropped 17 points today. That's nearly 0.2%, closed at 9,771.
The NASDAQ up 8 points, 0.4%, 2,057 at the bell. The S&P 500 ticked up 2 points, almost 0.25%, finished the day at 1,045. Investors jumped eagerly aboard the Buffett Express. As we mentioned earlier, Warren Buffett is buying the railroad company Burlington Northern Santa Fe. Shares chugged up more than 27%. Investors welcome news that toolmaker Stanley Works haven't had a plan to acquire Black & Decker. Shares of Stanley tacked on 10% today. Black & Decker nailed a 30% gain. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.47%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. $25 trillion of investment assets are accounted for with software from SunGard Financial Systems. More information at SunGard.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Wednesday. Senators John Kerry and Lisa Murkowski discuss climate change legislation and the upcoming conference in Denmark. House members hold several hearings on the federal response to the H1N1 flu. And Wednesday marks the 30th anniversary of the Iran hostage crisis, where 53 Americans were held for 444 days inside Iran's U.S. embassy. I'm Kevin Ferguson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
Free gets our letters segment going today. Free chicken, specifically. A couple of weeks ago, I sat down with our senior editor, Patty Hearst, to talk about the value in food giveaways, a chicken dinner from KFC, in Patty's case. He confessed he doesn't mind waiting around for his discounts, but many of you, like David Spaulding of Durham, North Carolina, said it's just not worth it.
The reality is that a free food giveaway like this attracts a lot of people, many of them the kind of rabble that I don't want to be in line with and jostling for my complimentary morsel.
He is many things, but Patty Hearst is definitely not rabble, I must say. In that same show, Sally Herships told us about a new doll in the incredibly popular American Girl line. Her name is Gwen, and she's homeless. The company says they hope she raises awareness of kids without a home. Did I mention here that the price tag is $95? We also learned in our letter segment this week that there is nothing like a high-priced toy to get you all to write in. Most of you felt like Patricia Johnson of Walpole, Massachusetts. If middle and upper-class children need to become aware of homelessness, she wrote, parents can take them to volunteer in a soup kitchen or a homeless shelter. Last week, we talked poverty with University of Michigan professor Sheldon Danziger about how the official poverty line of the future might be measured. David Burns from Needham, Massachusetts, especially enjoyed the good professor.
His BQ, his bloviation quotient, is zero in this piece. I hope to hear more from him.
BQ, by the way, is now an official Marketplace criteria for how we book all of our guests. We kicked off the climate race last week, a series on global warming. Lots of letters on that one. Kathy Schwem is an environmental scientist from Ventura, California.
Discussions about where to get energy, coal, nuclear, wind, etc., only look at one side of the equation. What we need to be concentrating on is the demand side of the supply equals demand balance. If we could really learn to use less energy, we wouldn't have to worry so much about production.
Murr Raim from Charlotte, North Carolina, offered this perspective about the Earth's rising temperatures.
Assuming global warming was caused by human activity, in what way would that be unnatural? Humans are as much a natural part of this planet's environment as any other critter. If people have changed the climate is still in a natural state, having not been adulterated by any unnatural influence.
One last thought about covering climate change before we move on. This isn't one of those stories where you can make everybody happy or include every point of view. About all you can hope to do, no matter how much time you spend on it, is make people think. So if we did that, or if we just made you mad, let us know. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. While most businesses are still trying to find their way out of the recession, for-profit higher education is doing quite fine, thank you very much. Enrollments are up 20%, profits are up as well. But that doesn't mean there aren't any problems. The biggest for-profit schools get most of their revenue from federal student loans, the billions of dollars that their customers borrow to pay tuition. The University of Phoenix is probably the biggest for-profit school out there, probably the best known as well. A couple of years ago, it paid the government $10 million over accusations about its high-pressure recruiting tactics. It has put aside another $80 million to settle a lawsuit about the same thing. And a joint Marketplace ProPublica investigation shows some for-profit schools are still abusing the system. Sharona Coots and Amy Scott reported our two-part series that starts today. Here's Amy.
You've seen the ads on mass transit, Facebook, and TV promising job retraining, online classes, flexible schedules.
I was the first in my family to graduate from college.
But I won't be the last.
Hundreds of thousands of Americans have been drawn to for-profit colleges like the University of Phoenix.
And I am a Phoenix.
Phoenix isn't the only school that profits from the stream of federal student aid, but it's the single biggest recipient. Last fiscal year, 86% of its revenue came from the federal government. That's more than $3 billion. But who's benefiting from all that money?
My name is Michelle Rambo, and I live in Grand Prairie, Texas.
Rambo signed up at the University of Phoenix in Dallas a few years ago.
I did tell them that I was pregnant, and they were like, oh, well, that just solves everything, you know. You qualify for a grant. You know you're covered. And I'm like, so I don't have to pay anything, and they told me no.
Classes went well. She got good grades. She was almost finished with her associate degree when a school counselor called about moving her on to a bachelor's program.
And one of the questions that she asked me completely stopped the whole conversation. She had asked me, so what kind of loan do you have?
Rambo thought she didn't have a loan, but when she enrolled, she signed what she thought was a form inquiring about federal aid. Turns out it was an application for loans that'll cost her $18,000 when she graduates.
It was scary. It still is scary. I'm still scared. I still don't even know what I'm going to do yet.
So how could this happen? It turns out the enrollment counselors at the University of Phoenix get paid in part based on how many students they recruit. The university's negotiating the settlement of a lawsuit that claims employees were pressured to sign people up. Bill Pepicello is president of the University of Phoenix. He says his school goes out of its way to ensure counselors don't mislead students.
We train our financial counselors very carefully to provide an array of options for students and to try to be as specific as they can as to, you know, what the implications of each of those are.
One financial aid expert told us it's not uncommon for students to sign a bunch of paperwork without really understanding the terms of their loans. Sound familiar? At a recent hearing, Congressman George Miller of California likened problems in student lending to another recent crisis.
I'm a little worried that we're developing a process here that looks a lot like sort of subprime student loans. And knowing that these people don't have the capacity to pay it back, knowing that they may not have the ability to benefit from this education, we go ahead and extend them the credit.
What he means by not benefiting is that many students saddled with debt don't finish their degrees. The for-profit industry says about 60% of its students graduate from two-year programs. The University of Phoenix says its rate is less than half that. But whether students drop out or graduate, they still leave school burdened with debt. And it's debt they can't escape.
It is very important to understand student loans are the most collectible obligation in the United States.
Barmak Nasirian is with the American Association of Collegiate Registrars and Admissions Officers.
Students who default on their student loans have their Social Security benefits intercepted, have their tax returns intercepted, have their wages garnished. They are ruined for life.
The Department of Education says more and more students are falling behind on their loans. For-profit schools have a higher default rate than the average. Harris Miller represents many for-profit schools as CEO of the Career College Association, a lobby group in Washington, D.C. He says defaults are higher at his schools not because they're for-profit, but because they sign up poor people, people who might not otherwise have a shot at college.
The simple fact is, if your institution is willing to accept lower-income students, which our institutions are, which community colleges are, which minority-serving institutions are, they have higher default rates.
The taxpayer actually makes money from the interest on these loans, but critics of the system say students often lose out. Not only are they deep in debt, they don't always have much to show for it. I went to see Catherine Clark at her home in Seal Beach, California. She signed up for a business management degree at the University of Phoenix. She says the program included courses like Skills for Lifelong Learning.
Like, they had worksheets where it was like, if you're deserted on an island and you have a list of things, put them in order of how they would be important to you. And I'm just like, are you kidding? What am I ever going to use this for?
Clark didn't qualify for federal student aid, so she paid some of the bill with credit cards. The rest she owes to a private lender, Sally May.
In total, I've paid out of my pocket $3,521, and I still owe $600.
And what did you get in return?
Absolutely nothing.
The Apollo Group, which owns the University of Phoenix, made just shy of $500 million in profit last year. But Barmak Nasirian says no one's keeping a close eye on the quality of the education for-profit schools like Phoenix provide.
In too many instances, we see keyboarding skills transcribed as computer science 101. We've seen working with Microsoft Windows as transcribed as a theoretical course in operating systems and the like.
Clark was so disappointed she dropped out after a course and a half. University of Phoenix officials say out of more than 420,000 current students, a few anecdotes don't tell the whole story. But Marketplace and ProPublica have heard other troubling accounts. Tomorrow you'll hear allegations of some abusive tactics for signing students up. With Sharona Coots of ProPublica, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, two items, actually, following on Ford's earnings report of yesterday. First of all, October sales. Not so bad, really, considering Detroit didn't have cash for clunkers propping it up. GM sales rose, Ford too. Chrysler's fell, though, pretty hard. Item number two, Opel. General Motors has been negotiating for months now on the sale of its European unit. A deal to sell Opel to a Russian and Canadian consortium was all but done. Sadly, though, nobody told the GM board. They voted today to back out of that sale. And we are backing out of the program. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 17 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ up 8 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 gained 2 points, almost 0.25%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this radio program, using shady tactics to boost enrollment.
One of the things that we were told is, you say we're regionally accredited, which means that they're transferable anywhere, which isn't true. They're eligible for transferability.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.